first thing, if you haven't opened the portal, you should open the portal. Because there is a quiz on it and there's homework. Homework is due on Monday. I see some of you guys get started. I hope you enjoy the flavor. And the quiz, what do I say? Okay, for the particular quiz, it's on group theory. So if you really want to drill your understanding of group theory, it'll be a very nice adventure of... So the idea that I write a quiz is like, I want to write it so hard that next year I wouldn't be able to do it. No, not really. But the point is, I'm not going to ask you to memorize things. Like if it belongs to the memorization set of things, I assume you can open the reference and find everything you need. So it's really, the quiz is supposed to challenge you a little bit. And don't be too sad that you know. If you got one quiz entirely right, you should really be like, wow, feeling, have this fantastic wow feeling if you manage to do that. But it's good for you, because I ask you to memorize and it would be like a waste of your time. Okay, so we're making progress on this puzzle. It's my first claim. Okay, without the pre-boarding, my puzzle looks weird. Okay, and this is the group theory that we have been play with, and the idea is today we'll find finally what the group theory gave quantum mechanics and the special relativity is the states. You will have a quantum state that is relativistic, i.e. Lorentz invariant. So that's where we are landing on. And hopefully, in the second half of the lecture, when we try to land there, and you will say, oh, okay, it's important, I have to know about the group theory, have to know about the some representation, and have to know about the structure constants. And those are the topics we covered recently. So that's where we're going. But so first, we should be feeling very happy at this point. So I find that I draw the rep for every single group. Isn't that amazing? And then it's a time for desperate feeling, a feeling of hopeless. Because, you know, there's a hopeless, for example, there's hopeless many of the algebra. In other words, there's an infinity number of them. And for each Lie algebra, there's hopeless many of representation. Oh, right, it's also infinity. And we seems don't have any more twos to start them. But the hope is not lost. You might have heard that the O, B1, is your only hope. It's our only hope. And that's not true. This is a lie. And you might also think maybe R2D2 is our only hope. And that's also not true. What we're going to learn today is that SU2 is our only hope. And now I'll try to defend this point. Okay, first, let me put on our mathematician, our own mathematician, Professor Thiel's head, says, that's it. I'm passionate about SU2. That's, I want to find all the representations because I'm a mathematician, right? Okay. But I think as a physicist, we need a little bit more motivation. So let me write down a chain of things. So SU2, as you all discovered yesterday, is similar to SO3. So this link we already checked. It's not just similar, it's even like over Z2 is isomorphic. It's like as similar as you can be. And if we only care about the close to identity, the generators, the algebra, they are exactly the same. And the next link is I hope I can convince you that SO3 is an obvious subgroup of the Lorentz. I think we're in a different universe compared to David, so I'll switch it. It's like I'm just not rotating in that direction. And hopefully, I will also, it's not good. I forgot which side of this thing is go to, towards the normal side or towards the non-normal side. But let me not write it. It's a semi-product. All I'm saying is Poincaré. Let's use physicist saying is Poincaré is Lorentz plus translations. That's all I want to say. So in this chain, this part we are going to do, or we already done in the first part of the homework, is that if I want to know an operator that come with Lorentz and the translation, if you have done the first part of homework, you already know how to write it as the translation. So you do rotation first, then you do translation later, and you will get a general Poincaré element. So that will be covered in the first half of the homework. And you can see that's the link. This is the link we're missing. And we're going to do that in the second half. But if I'm demonstrating all the link works, you can see why SU2 is going to help us to answer our big question of the week. Let me first say that this Psi prime is probably a linear combination of some other states. But this is still our big question. And we will answer that in the second half of the lecture. And now let me put it back the not so rigorous mathematician's head. Okay, I'm sorry that I didn't cover some Lie group concept as thorough as I should have. But I'm really running out of time because they're from the people who have failed the want to learn chart. I see a lot of people interested in QED. So we have a long way to go. Okay, so now let's put the not so rigorous math hat, and it says that let's start from the structure constant, because we know that if we have structure constant, we have everything we want. And then we claim, as a physicist, we want the unitary rep of the compact, simple group. So this SU2 has very many good properties. But unitary is what we impose. But then we also want to, but it is compact because all the rotational angles are 2 pi. As we realize, it's collected to SO3, so it's 2 pi. And then it's a simple group. It's actually the simplest simple group. Okay, but what does this tell us about our structure constant? So if we're looking for unitary representation, that means the structure constant is real. And if it is compact, it means it's completely anti-symmetric. Simple means, you know, the structure constant connects everywhere. There's no like sub-regions. Okay, so what's the simplest FABC you can give me that is real and completely anti-symmetric? Completely anti-symmetric? Real?
Levi-Civita.
Levi-Civita tensor. So, and you can see that, you know, as I mentioned, I just say, I'll define this Lie algebra to be SU2. So another definition. Sure, two definitions should agree. But we did this in a tutorial. Remember in the tutorial, we get an SU2, and we find the defining rep, and then realize the struct, the generators are half poly, and if you do half poly commutator, you will get the third poly matrix and with I in front. So this is the structure constant of SU2. We actually showed it secretly. Okay, so that's the defining rep. If we're talking about the matrices groups, then there's always a defining rep somewhere. Okay, but we actually did a little further. We find the three-dimensional rep. Yeah, okay, we find the three-dimensional rep for SO3 because that's its defining rep. But you know the algebra is exactly the same. So we can also take this rep, these rotations gave us some generator, and we call it the three-dimensional rep. So let me write one of these guys for you. It kind of look like this, right? It's a pair of minus II, depends on which direction I'm rotating. So now it's a cool thing. So this is the generator in the first direction, which is a rotation. And you have seen this yesterday. Okay? So now I'm gonna show you that where it comes from the other definition. The other definition says, if I want to study the first generator's matrix element, if it happens to be in the adjoint rep, which we kind of suspect because the dimension is 3, then I can use this thing to write it up. So the T1, the second row, third element, should equal to minus I times our structure constant, which is 1. So you realize, oh, we should have been very suspicious, even without remember that very beautiful map at the beginning, 3x3 map that nobody wants to calculate it by hand, even if we don't have that. But now we realize, wait a second, this three-dimensional defining rep of SO3 is exactly the adjoint rep of SU2. So we should be very suspicious that they must be related. Okay, yesterday I said something wrong, by the way. The Lie algebra is not a group near identity. It's the group near the identity, expanded by the identity, and what's left is the Lie algebra. Lie algebra formulate this algebra, which, for one thing, if the group is unitary, then the algebra is Hermitian. There's nothing is well, there might be something is both unitary and Hermitian, which is like an identity, but they are not the same. You can think of like the Lie algebra is kind of the derivative of the group at origin. Okay, so far this is what we know. And what do we proceed? Okay, I'll give you a general recipe. So the idea is somebody work out SU2 and realize, wait a second, everything I've done so far can be generalized. So that's why people says SU2 is our only hope, because if you solve SU2, everything else follows. There is also an appendix to tell you exactly how it follows. But we don't need that. We only need SU2. So let's stay on topic. And this is the recipe a mathematician would hand you. It says, take something that is maximally commuting. I mean, this is not too weird, right? You have a bunch of operators. You want to select the bunch that is maximally commuting with each other, so you can simultaneously diagonalize it. Smells like physics. But it's math. That's what they want to do. And okay, for SU2. So SU2 is so important, so everybody writes it as J for some reason. We'll stick with this. Then we agree with most of the references. Okay. So for SU2, what's the maximally commuting subset out of our three generators? Maximal. If I pick any of them, can I pick another one? Not really, right? So this step for SU2, can simplest stay on track? Being simplest, I can only pick one. Lesson of the day. If you're a lecturer, you shouldn't attach to the microphone to the moving part of your shirt. Never happened.
Well, what do you mean by maximum commuting?
It means like, I have, let's just stop trying to be abstract and generate for a second. Let's just say I have J1, J2, J3. So first thing, you can choose anybody. You literally can choose anybody. But every single reference I've ever seen, they all pick J3. But then if you pick J3, you're like, J2 and J3 is not a commuting. J1 and J3 is not a commuting. So we end up with only J3. But in a much more complicated group, like SU3, you will realize you can write all the 8 generators in some particular way, and in the way Gehrman write it down, you realize, hey, the 3rd and the 8th actually are commuting. So you have to pick 2 of them. But in our case, all good. Just pick one. And everybody wants us to pick that one. And the number, the maximally number we can pick, in jargon, is called the rank. That's literally what a rank mean, how many elements you can pick so that they are maximally commuting. You can't pick any more. Okay. Then we call this thing special. It's so special, we're going to use it to organize that the rest of the stuff. We say that for anything else, we want it to be organized as the eigenvector of a special. So the eigenvector is defined in the commutator way. So it's not a matrix product, but a commutator. But you can see the resemblance. Why would we call this thing an eigenvector? Your J3 commutator with it, and it pops out. Yeah? We call this sometimes the multiplication. So, commutator, multiplication, similar.
at least sometimes we can consider commutator as multiplication. So that's the second thing we want to do. Here is the question. How are we going to find this dot? What else do we have? J3 is here, right? J3, the commutator, which is J3, is not going to give us anything new but a zero. So what do we have left? J1 and J2. And we know J3 with J1 will give us J2, and J3 with J2 will give us J1 with some minus signs. So both of them are not good. So what can we do? That's all we have. We have J1, J2, and we know both of them are not good. Make a combination, right? Maybe it will work. So we claim this dot is J1 plus AJ2. You can see that if there is any overall factor, it's not going to affect this thing. Then you can find out, and you're like, what am I doing? Okay, in 2 minutes, I'll give you the physics motivation of this recipe. But I have to give the mathematician credit because the group theory is developed way earlier than quantum mechanics. So we'll have a motivation for doing this, but let's just follow the recipe because the first two steps are not hard. Okay. So we find something and you realize you just needed the A to be plus minus I. Not bad. And that's the physicist's normalization, have two things, and it was like obliged to put a square root two there. Okay. So this, you can do it in a few lines. Okay, this is what I should emphasize. Anytime in the lecture I said you can do this in a few lines, it's always in some footnote. It's always there. And unless it's on your homework. That's the only exception. Okay, so we got it. Some linear combination, and we will find this. There is only last step. The last step is called the highest weight method. And what I want to say is that whenever a mathematician says weight, apparently it means eigenvalue. Why? I hope someone will tell me, but I have no idea. So let's replace it by the eigenvalue. Okay, so I promised you, I'll give you physics motivation of all this crazy stuff, okay? Okay, very good. I want to write something, but now think about quantum harmonic oscillators, our beloved quantum harmonics oscillators. And later I'll ask you some questions. That'll be in class. Little, I wouldn't call it a quiz, but I want you to tell me everything that you think harmonic oscillator is important to me. Meanwhile, I'm putting up our toolbox. They are surprisingly useful. All right, quantum harmonic oscillator. Why is a quantum harmonic oscillator so useful? Why is it so important? I would say if you haven't, you know, experienced the quantum harmonic oscillator, then you haven't taken enough quantum mechanics. So why is it so useful?
The energy levels are evenly spaced.
I will call it it's solvable. Okay? It's very useful because we don't know many systems that are solvable. And if you want to talk about the solvable system, like Kevin is doing active research on them. Okay, now the question is, why is quantum harmonic oscillator solvable? What tools do we use to solve it? You want a hint? Thank you. Okay, now we just need to translate. What is a ladder operator? What does a ladder operator supposed to mean? Can you translate it into something like a formula for me? For example, I'll write a dagger. Why is it a ladder operator? In which way it's a ladder operator?
It can go through the excited states, like it's kind of a ladder.
Uh-huh.
Or to the...
So suppose I'm going and on the N letter N, it will give me letter N plus one. Perfect. We're almost there. Why? Why acting on N, it will give us N plus one? Now that's the key part. I'm sure you have all done this computation some time ago. So what do you mean by this thing is N plus one? You should know that. If I claim this one is letter N plus one, how do I know?
You apply the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, you measure the energy, right? And we'll throw the half, important half, but not for us. So we'll throw the half away. What I meant is this. No. Right? This is a dagger adding on N. I measure it, it reads N plus one. Perfect. And why this happens? So as a well-trained quantum mechanics people, whenever we see two operator, then Dirac says, no questions asked, just commute them. Good things will happen if you do that. But on the other hand, of course, bringing N close to this cat N will bring out an N. So maybe that's why we have this part, right? And it seems the important thing is to have something like this. You commute, you pick up the one, the N is next to the N vector, give you an N. Yeah? Do you agree? I'll to pick the minus, it just happened to work. It works for the annihilation operator. If I call it A minus, I can put it together. And now, just look at them. How beautiful they are. Stays right next to each other. It's the same. You call J3N, you call JA, it's exactly the same formula. So that gives us a sense why this eigenvector of a special is important. Because we can use the same tools we used for harmonic oscillator again. Whatever enable us to solve the quantum harmonics oscillator will, in principle, solve SU2, and in practice. So let's benefit from what we have here. And briefly review, how did we solve the quantum harmonics oscillator? The first step is we find the N operator, which is related to Hamiltonian. So we'll happily say maybe it has an eigenvector, and I'll call it N, and it has all this delta N prime, the orthonormal property and the stuff. Yeah, that's the step one. And then step two. Step two, we already seen it. Step two says the letter operator will change the letter. And then there is a step three. Says, well, it will be good for our letter to end somewhere because we don't want a negative infinity amount of energy. So this is, you can call it the boundary condition. And this basically summarizes everything we have studying the harmonic oscillator. So now we're doing exactly the same. Okay. Overestimate my height. One prime. So instead of this, what would we have? In this case, the N is important. And then in SU2, so back to SU2. Back to SU2. In this case, what is important? Days three? Yeah? So we're going to make eigenstates of them. And the next thing, without even do any calculation, we claim our J plus minus of M must be sending them to M plus minus 1. I mean, that's what we use to get to this point. So it must just carry through. And the rest are the slightly unimportant part is how to actually solve the system. But the first thing we do, follow mathematicians, is that we're going to get a boundary condition. So assuming at J that it annihilates. I mean, what's the rationale here? Well, you always want something to be annihilated so that you get a finite thing, finite letter. Ooh. Well, mathematicians, I said, I don't care about infinite letters. Ta-da. And then they all call it the highest weight. So if I start from the bottom, it will be different from all the mathematician reference. So we'll start from the top. It just says, this letter ends at a J. Psst, disappeared. Okay, so now we're complete. Now we just need to solve this system outlined by the three lines of information we punched out of quantum harmonic oscillator. Okay, so the next step are details. Is that it's basically, it's all about finding this proportional constant. It's kind of important because if you want to find a rep, it's kind of important to figure out what are these constants are. You can't just all call them one. So for us, for that, I'll say that I'll be happy with someone knows this about quantum mechanics. But for us, we need to dig a little deeper. And what mathematician tells us is if we don't know, then we assume. So we know that it's going to be M minus 1. I have no idea what's the proportional constant, so we assume that. it's always a good idea just to assume the things you don't know, and hopefully when you know it at the end. So it sounds like basic grade 7 or 8 algebra. Okay, but I'm going to write this in a different way. I say that one way to interpret this sentence is the operator acting on a state produce another state. But the other way to interpret it is the matrix element of this operator on this two particular state is given by this. Yeah? I see nodding. That's very good. And the next thing I'm going to just say is that G, you can interpret this line as G minus acting on M and overlap with M minus 1. But I can totally interpret it as it's a G plus acting on the left and the overlap. So this operator you can associate it with like a cat or the bra. That's my choice. And if you do that, you will find the normalization for G plus too. So you only need, I forgot to mention, but because this plus minus I thing, these two things are Hermitian conjugate of each other. So it's a pair. And because of that, you only need to assume one normalization constant, and the other will follow. Okay. So what do we do now? We assume the J minus, we assume the J plus. How am I going to solve for N of M? What do you think? Look at the two box. Which two do you think we should use now? We know J minus, we know J plus. Expansion? We already expanded. That's why we're talking about Lie algebra. Linear combination? Wait, we just did a linear combination from J1, J2 here. And remember what Dirac says? I actually don't know when did he say that. But everybody says, Dirac says, whenever you have two operator, commute them. Okay, so that's all the useful information. And now I'm just going to write out the rest of the results. So when you commute them, you find an interesting fact. When you commute them, you realize it's going to be J3. And that's it. And this can't be very hard because we know what's J plus, we know what's J minus, we know all the combinator with J1, J2. Just trust me, J3 will pop out. And now the trick is take an expectation value. Oh, it looks like that's what I'm doing. Okay, so this will give me J plus, J minus, and this one will give me J minus, J plus. So I can write the first term as the modular square of J minus, because J plus acting on the left is J minus acting on the right. Similarly, I can write the second term as J plus. And the right-hand side is just M, because J3 is where M is. Okay. So that, by definition of these constants, will give us a recursive relationship. it's the same when you solve recursion relationships. So you're saying you have a huge list and add them up, but you can also plug into Mathematica says R solve means recursive solve. You put this in and put our boundary condition in, which is you can't raise it anymore. There's the highest letter. And then you get this thing. And at this point, we solved the whole thing. The only thing we were missing before is these constants. And now you can solve it for any J, any M. Okay. So I want you to stare at this expression. I mean, it's not pretty. So let's stare at it and find some physics on it. What do you think it would be interesting thing to get out of that function? That's a function, we care something, what do we care? You have a function and you draw it. Zeros, right? We'll care about zeros. And I'll just point it out. M equals J plus one is a zero. Well, sanity check. Good. We imposed the condition, a condition come out. Sanity check. So, but we're not getting anything from sanity check except our sanity. But the other thing is interesting, tell me that when M equals minus J, this thing vanish. In other words, J minus acting on minus J is zero. So now it's a useful thing to do to draw a letter. And to think about it. Okay. I'll give you some starting point and a claim that this is my M state. Okay. So what can I do start from my M state? You can use J plus to go up. Yeah? On the other hand, I can use J minus to go down. And the upper run, the letter ends at the J. Because you do J plus, it turns into zero. But that's our assumption. That's what the mathematician wants, is terminates there. But what the solution makes us really happy for people looking for the finite rep of SU2 is it terminates down too. And that's not an assumption. That's just what the computation gave us. And this minus J will go down to zero. So how many, so here is the question. How many these things, how many steps? How, like from minus J to J, how many steps are there? Each time you climb one. So if you do from minus J to J, yeah? 2J plus one. I always miss the plus one, but it's very good. The answer is 2J plus one. On the other hand, what kind of interesting mathematical property do steps have? How would you, in the number sense? what a kind of a number when I take a step?
Integers.
The integers. You've never seen people taking like 40.49 steps. They're integers. So we have this interesting discovery. We're looking for SU2's reps. But then we realize this J, this highest weighted J, can only be half integer or integer. That's where the 2J, the 2, gave us. And then now I make this cool physical connection. What is integer or half integer?
Spin.
Hence, SU2 is tremendously important for physicists because it describes spin. There are other important SU2 not related. The space-time SU2 is related to spin. Okay. So let's see. Spin 0. Okay, trivial. Everything mapped it to 1, who cares? J equals 1/2. We already know this is Pauli. And that's what you're gonna get. So the idea is, I write it somewhere. The idea is, because you know the proportional constant of these things, and let's see, we can do this. I claim this is the matrix element. The only thing we need to figure out is the proportional constant, and you write a delta. Yeah, do you agree? The fact that they are letter operators means they are only going to relate it to two states when the two states are different by 1. And the number is given by that. Which means according to this rule, you can write down what's J plus. You can just pick. We pick J equals 1/2. You write what's J plus, what's J minus, what's J3. And then you combination back to look what's J1, J2, J3, guess what you find? What do you think doing this exercise? By finding the matrix element of J plus and J minus, in other words, by finding the representation of J plus and J minus, and then reversed back to J1, J2, what do you think you'll find at the 2 dimension? You found it yesterday, 2 dimension. Pauli. You will find exactly Pauli. I even have a problem to go with this, if you want. And J equals 1, on the other hand, will give us a 3-dimensional experiment. 3-dimensional representation. And for example, I'm just going to write a J3 because J3 is the eigenvalue, minus 1, 0, 1. So it turns out, if you take this, and then you take your 3-dimensional rotation yesterday, you can find a similar transformation. And now you just need to show the similar transformation of your J minus and a J plus. J1 and the J2 will agree with the other 2 rotation. Then you proved, yes, you can find the adjoint representation. Yes, you can find the representation in this highest weight method, but they are the same representation. Okay, so, but this is really powerful. Now you can give me an integer. J equals 56. I will be able to find you a 56 times 2 plus 1 by that dimension matrix. And that is the SU2 representation in that dimension. 3 matrices. and they are guaranteed to satisfy the structure constant. So we know. So now we can happily conclude we know all the possible rep. It's literally covering every single integer of SU2. We did an exhaustive search, and we should use it. Okay, fun fact, if just to lure you to read about the appendix, you can actually represent SU2 geometrically like this. It's kind of silly. There are three dots on in a line. And I claim J3 sits in the center because that's a special one. And J plus and J minus can move it around. And you're like, where are you getting with this? Now we consider SU3. SU3 has eight generators, 3 square minus 1. And it turns out two of them are maximally commute, so they should be special and be in the center. How many are there left? 6, right? What shape do you think it will form?
Hexagon.
A hexagon. So you don't have to do any work. You conclude SU3, I must be able to organize the 8 generator into a hexagon. And that's actually exactly what Dinkson, the Dinkson diagram guy, did. He's using all this little diagram, but some diagram derived from this diagram, and it says, oh, very good. I can classify all the simple Lie algebra for you. Done. And basically, what the mathematician in those days discovered is this angle is very special. It can only take the special angles we learned about the sine and cosine, like the ones that are easy to remember. They can only be pi over 6, pi over 4, pi over 3, 0, and pi over 2, and the other similar ones. But that you have to actually read the appendix to find out why. Okay. I think this is good. We're feeling good. We solved the SU2 thoroughly, completely. And we know that a similar method will lead us to solve everything completely. So we're happy. And let's bring it back to Poincaré in 5 minutes. First, I'm going to modify our big question by already taking infinitesimal. And then I will do some expansion around my, just as I do for the all the other group. I'm going to find my generators and then only care about the generators and the rest of my life. Okay, so for Poincaré group, I can tell you a few things. It's kind of depressing. First, they are not a billion. Well, that's not bad, but they are not even compact. And they are not a simple. And they're not even semi-simple. So you can see, nature is not giving us an easy time. And now you say, oh crap, what do I do? It's in no way a easy to study group. But nevertheless, we want to make some progress. Maybe I should write the E. Much bigger. Okay, the idea is we pick what we can, right? Also, what did we just learn? What we just learned is that if there are a bunch of operators, what do we do with them to pick the easy fruit? the same way that you want to solve the Hamiltonian system, you want to
find the commutators.
And if the commutators are, what would be the easiest? If I have some bunch of commutators, and I look at the right-hand side.
Zero.
We do the same. Find the maximally commuting operators. What do you think? Out of momentum, three rotations and three boosts, which are the maximally commuting? Momentum. Okay, that we know. Very good. So these are my easy picked fruit. It's zero. So I'm going to say that I'm going to define a quantum state is labeled by the momentum and some discrete label that I haven't found yet. I want to call it a spin. But see, after your homework, you discover this thing. Your homework does a very general thing. But after you finish it, you can ask any two generator and say what it looks like. And they say, rotation with momentum will give some momentum back. So at this point, we can't really conclude that's spin because we don't have the rotation generator. But nevertheless, we'll just call it sum, no s. And then I can immediately claim, says, I know how to do this because they are maximally commuting. I'm just going to replace the operator by eigenvalue. Yeah? Easy peasy. And I claim I don't even have to be infinitesimal. You can translate whatever you want, but a translating momentum pick up a plane wave vector because of this. And because of the nice property of doing multiplication of exponential with only numbers. Okay, first step is clear. The second step, as I told you, that you will find in your first part of the homework, something more complicated than this, but a collinear is that if you have a Poincaré transformation, you can always break it into doing rotation first and then doing translation. See? Either you have seen the homework and you know your T transformation and you can just check, or you will see it in the homework. So that seems to tell me, okay, it's easy to do the link between Poincaré and Lorentz. Right? It tells me if I know Lorentz, I already know momentum. Translation, I must be able to do the Poincaré. So now all the focus is on this guy. Okay, so I'll drop the zero. And what do you think the result would be? Don't even think about this particular question. If you put an operator on the state, what's your generic result would be? In the letter operator, you get particular state. That's very nice. But in general, what do you get? Lots of states. Exactly, superposition of states. So I can just write this. Some coefficient, who knows? And some other states. Progress. But at least we know what's the momentum. You have a P, you push the with the Lorentz transformation lambda, and it's lambda P. Believe or not, we showed this in a footnote that it's actually lambda P, very legitimately. But now you can just, I can just wave hand. Okay. So those coefficients, according to Weinberg's book, his naming system is not very good, but this one is okay. So the idea is just you have some coefficient not only depend on the transformation you do, but also depend on momentum. Well, see, normally that's not desirable, right? That means for basically for each different of this state, then the rule of writing this down will be different. Different P gives you different lambda P. So undesirable. So now what do we do? There are several ways I want to say about this, but what do you think the easiest thing is? If you want to make a wish, and I'll tell you why your wish will become true, but if you want to make a wish, what a lambda P equals would make your life so much easier?
Constant.
Constant would be an answer, but let me try, say, let's do a small parameter expansion. What's the first term? Identity times P. So the zeros order approximation. Okay. A little sketchy. We'll come back to other situation, okay? But we'll stick with this for now. It says, if I can solve this, well, I achieved something. So this thing is special, right? Hence, they deserve a new name. I'm writing this down exactly the same, but giving them a new name. And the momenta is called a reference momenta. It can be any momenta you want, as long as they satisfy the P squared equals M squared stuff. But then, the thing that doesn't change the reference momenta are called a little group. It's a smaller. And it doesn't change the momentum. Okay, now you ask the question. Suppose I don't I'll care about the lambda later, but if I only do this, and you can see the weird problem of the momentum disappeared because it's always k. And this, what you can do is to perform this . We are still in a representation. This will implies this D thing is in a rep. Whatever W is. Okay, remember when we're looking for reps? They're numbers, only numbers. No P's, no momentum tagging along. It says if we get rid of this momentum problem, then indeed we find, oh, those are just bunch of numbers. It's a representation of this little group. And here is the highlight of today. Let's pick some reference momentum for massive particles. If it's a massive particle, what a kind of momentum you like to pick? for massive particle, which momentum is more superior than more other momentum?
Angular momentum.
Huh?
Angular momentum.
Momentum, a four momentum. A four momentum. The reference momentum is a four momentum, yep.
I could go to like the rest frame or something.
The rest of frames. Will be nice, it just sits there and do nothing. Go to the rest frame again, this. Okay, very good. So now let's look. The symmetry of this reference momentum, the transformation of this reference momentum is called its little group, which is what is little group? What kind of symmetry transformation will leave our reference momentum not changed?
SO3.
SO3. So there's three directions. You can rotate however you want. If it's rest, it's still at rest. And wait, yesterday we learned SO3 is basically you off by a factor of two, but it's basically SU2. And this I'm going to be happily says solved because we know all the SU2 rep. If you want, I can write down any of these, this. For no matter what your S and S prime is. And you were like, but that means S is spin. S is a spin, but we also take the thing to be rest. So if you look at this algebra makes spin not a good label at the beginning, it's because it has no momentum. So when we say, how do we label a state, quantum state that's relativistic? What we should say is that we label by its four momentum and the spin at rest. Okay. So that's pretty good. This problem is solved. And you were like, but you only solved for the rest frame. It's not always that easy. So the claim is that for a general state, the claim is if I have a reference momentum, especially it's at rest, I can have a way just to boost it. Have any momentum. You have a rest momentum, I can construct you a boost such that it works. And this does have a specific formula, but you don't want me to copy that on the floor, on the board. For us, it's important to realize it exists. And then, this is the definition. It says you take a case state, I apply the boost, then I call it's the P state. Okay, there should be a normalization there, but it doesn't. As long as you stick with dense, more supreme normalization, that constant is one. That's why I'm not writing. So Weinberger has that constant carried out three chapters. I think I almost cried. And Dan has to really just like argue with me, says, no, my normalization constant is better. So all the normalization constants are equal, but Dan's is more equal, is the moral of the story. Okay, so now we still want to find out if I put a Lorentz transformation, what happens to it. So it's you start with a K, then you boost, and that's the hard part. You do a Lorentz transformation, what happens to the state? And you're like, huh. But let me draw you a triangle. It's the important triangle of today. See this? At this point, I'm at a momentum k. And then what happened to me next is I got boosted. And I'm boosted p. And what happened to me next is that I'm Lorentz transformation to lambda p. So what do you want to do with such a journey of one particle? It has momentum k, it gets boosted to bp, and it has the Lorentz transformation, now it's lambda p. What would be good? Just visually appealing from the geometry point of view. If I give you these two lines. I mean, maybe it's more beautiful if you like this goes off and draw a butterfly and the stuff. But what is a simple? What would you find visually appealing to be simple? What's the simplest thing to make this thing into? To draw the next line, right? Okay, now there's the question. Why do I want to draw this line? So there is a momentum. I brought it to be p, and I brought it to be lambda p. I say, it'll be nice if it's brought back to k. Why is it nice? A momentum k did some circle somewhere and come back to k. What kind of transformation would that be? If a momentum goes through a bunch of transformation and it didn't change. This seems to bring us to a little group. Yeah? So we are going to artificially create this situation such that the momentum doesn't change after the journey. You're like, but you're not equal to whatever you start with. And that's a problem we're going to solve. But the first thing I'm claiming is that if I have a momentum and I boost it to be p and did the Lorentz transformation, now what I need is a like anti-boost. I need you to be boosted back to k. But that's not good. I kind of just like create more terms. Yeah? So I must compensate it by the inverse. Yeah? So the most important logic is why is this term added corresponding to this line? Why would I do k go to p, go to lambda p, and come back to k? Well, the reason I want to go do that is that, well, the thing I added, there's nothing I can do. But all those three things, I'm going to call it a u of w. W depend on lambda p, but it's u of w. Anyway, so this u will take k to a k state. Because, okay, let me copy down again what's going in the middle. So this is the transformation we did traveling around that circle. It gets boosted to bp and become lambda p and become lambda inverse lambda p so that it travels a circle And that deserved to be called a little group because it didn't change the momentum. And the next thing happens is you say, well, we solved little group. We solved a little group. We know what's this. This is equivalent to some representation. And they are representations, so they are just a bunch of numbers. I can pull it out and write which these two together. Okay, now we need a final step, is recognize. The last step is to push k to momentum lambda p. So by using little group, we actually find out our answer. That the u lambda acting any state we want will be in principle calculable. So this is where we land, is that because we know all the rep of SU2, we can figure out how a, say, rest particle, how a Lorentz transformation will act on a rest particle. And because of this little group, we can construct a little group with a general boost and a general rotation. And now we can use the little group representation we just discovered. And finally, we're able to answer if I have a state, general state, with P and S, if I act Lorentz transformation on it, what will become? And this is the answer to the big question. So this is that, because this is our basis. If we know how it works on basis, it should work for any general state you gave me. So this is very strange. Because with group theory's help, we find this relativistic quantum state, which is really the link between quantum mechanics and the special relativity. And in the wake we follow, it's like a roller coaster. And the first day is like, oh, I can do so much because I have quantum states. And I can do so much such that I can even write down my scattering amplitude. And I can have some requirement from the special relativity. Ha, we don't need a field. And then we'll go to the field side that says, no. Say, because of this, you need me. And we'll actually do something really cool, is trying to build a field from the creation annihilation operator. I mean, we can define the creation annihilation operator out of the state. So we're going to do exactly opposite of what you have seen in dense QFT. In QFT, you start with a field, and you find some creation annihilation operator, and you find the state. Now we're going to go backwards. And then we'll have fun building field from scratch. And then the next week we'll say, okay, now I have confidence that why there is a field in quantum field theory, we'll go back to our normal-ish route to study Dirac spinners. But so far you should be having a huge cliffhanger. Wait, where is field? Okay, so the class is over.